Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of April. Our guest this hour is here to talk about a lot of issues, along with a wonderful project she's spearheading. But she wrote yesterday, or Tuesday actually, about Ford Motor Company having its strong first quarter. In fact, the U.S. automaker having its best first quarter earnings in 13 years, reporting a net income of $2.6 billion, which comes out to 61 cents per share, much higher than the expected 50 cents per share. Part of the reason for the success? We are going to talk about that. It could be their fuel-efficient models, which are becoming quite popular because gas prices, of course, are very high. Our guest is involved in a project that is called Changing Gears. Michelin Maynard is senior editor of Changing Gears. It is a multi-year project that looks at the future of the industrial Midwest with a twofold mission, journalism and public engagement. It's a product of the Upper Midwest Local Journalism Center, created through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And they have several host stations, Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, Chicago Public Radio, and IdeaStream in Cleveland. Each week they offer feature reports aired on the stations, and the project will also include documentaries and regional call-in programs. Michelin is a journalist, an author, and a scholar, and she was 10 years with the New York Times. She was a senior business correspondent, reporter, and Detroit bureau chief, covering the auto industry's devastating decline, as well as the airline industry. She is a frequent guest on NPR. She is taught at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of four books, including The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Mickey is a native of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we're very happy to have her as a guest this first hour of the program as we look not only at what's happening with the auto industry, but what's happening with industry in the Midwest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ah,
Kathleen.
You're there.
Thanks.
Everything's working.
Thanks so much for that nice introduction.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Do you like to be called Mickey or Michelin?
Mickey is fine.
Is okay. All right. We'll call you Mickey then. Well, let's start with, before we get into the project, which is fascinating, let's talk about the news you've been reporting on. And you've been covering the auto industry for a long time. Really phenomenal news from Ford Motor Company, huh?
Well, there's some interesting news from Ford, and then just in this morning, some more news from Chrysler. So if you'd like, I can start with what's going on at Ford.
Sure.
Well, this week, they reported first quarter earnings of $2.6 billion, which was their best in 13 years. There hasn't been a first quarter like this since the late 1990s. And the big difference between now and then is that back then they were making all their money on SUVs and pickup trucks. And now they've actually found a way to make money selling small, fuel-efficient cars.
And people are buying them.
They are
obviously
buying them. Yeah, and it was an interesting switch by Ford. They have a CEO named Alan Mulally, who was at Boeing. He ran the Boeing aircraft division before he came to Ford in 2006. And when he got there, this is someone that was pretty worldly wise. He'd traveled all over the world and knew that the rest of the world drove small cars. And he also knew that even if gas prices at the time weren't high, that they were going to be high. So he essentially directed the company to start a switch to more fuel-efficient vehicles. And I might add that Ford still sells plenty of F-Series pickup trucks and plenty of SUVs, but even those vehicles are about 20 to 25% more fuel efficient than they were when he took over the company.
Is this Fiesta a big seller for Ford? Has it really taken off?
Well, the Fiesta is one of its best-selling cars around the world, and it's new to the United States. They have a whole line of small fuel-efficient vehicles that are just arriving. The Focus is one of them. The Fiesta is one of them. It'll be joined by more of these smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles in their lineup. So it's hard for a lot of people who drive pickups and SUVs and big cars to believe it, but small cars are actually one of the fastest-growing segments in the American car market.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of gas mileage are we looking at for those fuel-efficient vehicles?
specifically, first of all, the federal government is going to require the automakers to get an average fleet fuel economy of about 35 miles per gallon by 2015. So we have to improve fuel efficiency anyway across the board. Those vehicles are getting, if you're driving, you know, sort of in a moderate fashion, you should be getting 30, 35, even 40 miles per gallon from those vehicles at this point.
Mm-hmm. Which isn't bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a hybrid, actually.
Oh, you do?
I've been averaging about 40 to 43 miles per gallon. And let me tell you, here in Chicago, I've seen gas selling as high as $4.69 a gallon.
Isn't that something? It really knocks you out when you see it these days. Every time I see it, I go, $4.10.
Well, when you think, I think about it in terms of what can I get for $20, because, you know, I like to buy about $20 worth of gas at a time. And just a year ago, you could almost fill up the car for that. And now it's it's 4 gallons, 5 gallons.
Right. And the news from Chrysler today, what is it?
Well, what's going on with Chrysler is, you know, Chrysler was one of the companies that filed for bankruptcy through a federally backed bankruptcy. General Motors was the other one. And in their bankruptcy filing, they borrowed $7.5 billion from the American government and the Canadian government in order to restructure themselves. So now Fiat, which actually has management control of Chrysler, and they own about 30% of the company, they are going to refinance this debt. They're not saying who they're borrowing from, and they're not saying what kind of interest rate they'll be paying, but they've been paying as high as 14% on the government loans from the United States and 20% from Canada. So they'll be very relieved to get out from under those high interest rates.
Mm-hmm. And GM?
Well, General Motors seems to have its restructuring on track. General Motors went public last year. They had also gotten money from the federal government, a lot more than Chrysler. They got something like $55 billion from the government, and the government still owns quite a large stake in General Motors and probably will for the time being. General Motors stock, when it was first issued, I believe it was issued at about $33, $35 a share, and it has been dropping lately. And there are some people saying that the Treasury ought to just dump its General Motors stock and get out of the company. But it's our money, and I'm sure a lot of people who balance their budgets would say, wait and see if the stock price goes up before that happens.
Mm-hmm. So all in all, this would be fairly good news for the administration, who made us people who own these companies, right, by giving them money.
Well, you would think so, except the one thing that's haunting everyone is gas prices. And there are, I think folks were hoping that this could be a really strong year for the auto industry. You might remember that 2 years ago, sales were as low as about 10 million vehicles in the United States. And that compares with 17 million in the middle of the last decade. So that's about 40% drop in car sales. Last year, it inched up a little bit to about 11.5 million. Now, Ford is saying they think sales this year could come up significantly to about 13.5 million cars for the whole country. But that doesn't take into account what might happen with gas prices. That doesn't take into account what's happening with the Japanese companies who've had to cut their production. And then I think another issue that faces a lot of people is still what's going on in the housing market. You know, people had those home equity loans and they bought cars with home equity loans. But if you sell your house, that's debt. You have to cover that debt. And so there are some people with some very complicated financing right now, and a new car is about the last thing that they want to think about.
I heard on the radio, I think yesterday, that the average person, which seems to me to be a long time, is keeping a car for 10 years now.
Okay, so let me explain that, because that does sound like a long time. There are many people, I'm sure many of your listeners, who buy a car and pay it off and keep it forever. I know lots of folks who do that. There are also people who get a 3-year lease. And then at the end of the lease, they turn in the car and they lease another car. So what that 10 years refers to are the people who buy a car, pay it off, and keep driving it. And also, let's remember that for every one new car sale, there are 3 used car sales. So most people in this country don't buy new cars. Most people buy used cars. And so if you're buying a car that's already 5 years old and you're keeping it another 5 years, that's how you get to 10 years.
I see. And your car, you could make a pretty penny on that hybrid you've got right now, Mickey, couldn't you?
You know, somebody suggested that this would be a good time. It's a 2008. It actually has about 56,000 miles on it. So I don't think it's a great bargain, but it's a nice little car. I didn't get the current version, which has a lot more bells and whistles. I got the version before that, and I've been very satisfied with it, although I actually have a piece, if you go to Marketplace, the NPR program, I have a piece this week giving advice on their website about whether you should downsize from an SUV to a small car and all the things that you have to think about when you do that, because it is an adjustment. And I can just envision listeners in Wisconsin saying, you know what, I live up north and I need my pickup truck. There's no way I can be driving up here in a hybrid. And in fact, when I went up to the Upper Peninsula last summer, I didn't see a whole lot of hybrids up there. So they aren't necessarily practical for everybody in your listening audience.
So what has all this good news done for people needing jobs, holding on to jobs, creating new jobs in the industrial Midwest?
Well, this is one of the dilemmas of this whole sort of slow recovery and one of the issues that we're looking at in Changing Gears, because we're seeing almost a jobless recovery. Now, unemployment rates have been dropping in our region. They're down in Michigan. They're down in, I believe, in Wisconsin as well. But there are two things happening. First of all, people are giving up. They are, you know, you look for a job for 6 months and then you drop out and you do odd jobs or your family helps you out and you're not employed anymore. And the second thing that's happening is that people are getting jobs, but they're not making the money that they used to make. And I'll use the car companies as an example. In the contracts at the Detroit car makers with the UAW, they're allowed to pay significantly lower wages to new hires. They're called two tiers. So you could be a veteran UAW member making $28 an hour, working next to somebody making $16 an hour. Now, that's a job, and it's a job in manufacturing. And so it does demonstrate growth in manufacturing jobs. But it's not at the old pay rate, and it's not at the old level of benefits.
Well, that's not very good for morale, is it?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of folks have been out of work for a while. A lot of folks face getting jobs at, you know, Walmart or jobs on construction sites that might pay $7 or $8 or $9 an hour. Though I think construction pays a little more than that. But if you know what I mean, by comparison, there are a lot of people who would line up to earn $16 an hour. So they certainly have takers for them.
Yeah. And the car market, talk about your foreign sales, too. Are some of these companies finding an open and heavily pocketed market elsewhere in Europe or in Asia?
Well, what's been interesting in the last couple of months, I guess since March 11th, is to see what happened to Japanese car makers in the wake of the earthquake and the tsunami, because we had the sense that this might be a year when Toyota picked up some of the sales that it lost over the last couple of years because of all the issues involving their recalls. I think people were expecting Honda to do better. Certainly Nissan was expecting to do better. And then along came this terrible tragedy. And one of the issues that they're running into is an interruption in their parts supply network. It isn't so much that the big factories can't run, because a lot of those big factories aren't anywhere near where the earthquake was, but a lot of smaller parts suppliers were up in the northern part of Japan. So that has a ripple effect. It affects production in Japan, and it affects the parts that are shipped over to the United States for their plants in the United States. So I guess what you can say is that it's put a giant sort of a cloud, no pun intended, over the Japanese market. But that doesn't mean that foreign automakers aren't doing well, because Volkswagen has some very aggressive plans to grow its American sales. They're talking about selling 1 million cars a year in the United States someday. They've never sold, I don't think, over about 750,000 cars a year at their peak back when the original Beetle was around. So Volkswagen's being very aggressive, and Hyundai and Kia, the Korean car makers, are being very aggressive as well. And they're growing leaps and bounds in market share.
The parts then for the American-made automobiles are all made in America, or are they not made, some of them, in Japan?
Oh, no. In fact, there's a great story. If people are interested in automotive electronics, I would send them to today's New York Times, because there's a story in there about chips that are used in automobile engines and computers, and how this one little factory in the north of Japan was the place that I think built 40% of the chips used in everybody's cars.
Oh, my.
So that little factory being damaged in the tsunami is affecting almost the entire auto industry, not just the Japanese car makers. Parts come from everywhere. Parts come from Mexico and Canada and China and all throughout the United States and even Latin America. So what we are finding is that as we go to a global industry, that this interruption in the parts supply network can affect anybody. It can happen very unexpectedly.
Right. Changing gears for a moment to talk about changing gears. What an interesting project you have going. Can you tell me about how it got started and what your mission is?
Sure. Well, Changing Gears is part of a project that's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which obviously provides funding to NPR stations and to PBS. And basically, their vision was twofold. First of all, they wanted the kind of journalism that would be what I call a two-way conversation, where you wouldn't just be sort of doing stories and putting them out there and walking away from them, but they wanted the public to be involved as well. They wanted back and forth, Twitter, Facebook, our website, the whole idea that we write a story and people comment on it and add to it. And then the also other idea was that we could sort of sponsor public events, have call-in shows, things like what you do at Wisconsin Public Radio, where people could get involved in the conversation. And then the second interest of CPB was in regional journalism, because I think the feeling was that our regions have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. So Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio have a lot in common, but it's rare that the news in this region will be covered on that basis. So if you just look at what happened in Wisconsin with your protests in Madison, with the whole collective bargaining issue, that has been an issue in Indiana. That's an issue in Ohio. It's one in Illinois, and it's one in Michigan as well. And so what Changing Gears tries to do is provide that regional context. And we were very happy when the Ideas Network joined us earlier this year for a call-in show on the whole issue of collective bargaining. It was just great to see Wisconsin Public Radio involved.
And also, we feel like we're kind of the center of national attention now,
Absolutely.
Too, because of all that's going on, aren't we?
I believe so. And I think there's an endless amount of interest in our region. The Great Lakes, first of all, you know, the largest freshwater body system in the United States and a very important one in the world. You have these great industrial cities, Milwaukee, Detroit, Cleveland. Chicago is an industrial city, even though people don't primarily think of it as one. And then all the cities like Janesville and Kalamazoo and Warren, Michigan, and Moraine, Ohio, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, all those places that we know because they had car plants and engine plants. Kenosha is another place.
Sure.
And all those cities that lost factories have to reinvent themselves. So there's just an endless supply of stories for us to be doing, and looking at the people stories as well, because this is a story of individuals and how they're going to plot the rest of their lives.
And you're a Michigan person. It must feel good for you to be home.
It is great to be home, and I loved every minute that I worked for the New York Times, but one of the things that I found was that these kinds of stories can be done maybe a couple of times a year, and I felt particularly that there was need for more attention to be paid to them, and I'm really glad that I've been home in the region when everything was going on in Madison and when everything's been going on with the new governor in Michigan, because I think this is laying groundwork that the rest of the country could end up following.
We're going to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Michelin Maynard is our guest, senior editor of Changing Gears and author of several books, including The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. We started with the pretty remarkable news this week from Ford, really good news about their profits, and Chrysler announcing pretty good news this morning as well. So we're looking at what that means, how they've changed the product, and how it might be stymied by the very high price of gasoline right now, which may portend future problems for a growing economy. They're doing regional stories, so this whole we got a couple things going on here. This whole idea of this regional journalism is also what Miggy is doing right now. And I'd like to entertain this bigger question, which we have in the past, and that's what will spark the economy in the Midwest? Is there something peculiar about us, something special about what we've done, our industrial base, and we should move forward, and we will highlight those areas that have been able to move forward? How have they done so? To your phone calls in just one moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, the author of Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. Andrew Ferguson will be joining us. Andrew is senior editor at the Weekly Standard and is author of Fool's Names, Fool's Faces, a collection of essays, and Land of Lincoln. So he will be with us. Let's go to phone calls. Vince in Milwaukee. Hello, Vince.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling because you had mentioned how Ford is making an investment in more fuel-efficient cars, and you noted the Ford Fiesta. When you look at the Ford Fiesta that is produced and sold in the United States, it gets 38 miles per gallon. When you look at the Ford Fiesta that's produced and sold in the United Kingdom, it gets 76 miles per gallon.
Really?
Which, when you do the conversion from imperial gallons to English gallons, it still gets 60 miles per gallon. Now, they use a turbo diesel engine as compared to a gasoline engine. And the question that I have is, why don't we have access to those here in the U.S., and how can we get Ford to start either producing or exporting them to the U.S.?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, first of all, it's a little bit apples to oranges to compare a gasoline engine to a diesel engine. They're different animals, and driving conditions in Europe are different than our conditions here. People tend to drive more within towns, a little bit of freeway driving, but certainly not the freeway driving that we do here. But I think your question is really, why don't we have more diesels? And there are some diesels that are available for sale. I think this stems from two things. First of all, emissions requirements for diesels, because bringing over a car from Europe that's a diesel there and a diesel here still requires some tuning up, I guess is the best way to put it. It's more expensive. American emissions laws are stricter than those in Europe when it comes to diesels. The second thing is diesels have a really bad reputation stemming from the 1980s when car makers threw diesel engines into cars that really hadn't been created for cars. And people might remember maybe back then that the engines were noisy, balky, sooty. And it's hard to find diesel fuel. That's a whole other issue. In a lot of places, you can only find it at truck stops, and there are a lot of folks that don't want to go out of their way for diesel to fill up a diesel car. Also, diesel fuel is not that much cheaper than gasoline. It used to be a lot cheaper, and now I believe it's right around the same price as unleaded. And I'm sure diesel users will correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that diesels, if we can get the emissions issue, if we can get the federalization issue and the cultural issue all sort of turned in the right direction, that we will see diesels in this country.
We should talk, thank you very much, Vince, for the call, a little bit more about the price of fuel and how it could stymie significantly in economic recovery and really is hitting people in the pocketbook. It's hard to pay for gasoline and heat your house and all of that. What are your thoughts on that? What's causing it, and whether or not you see it coming down anytime in the future?
I'd be rich if I could answer that question. Just as someone with an automotive background and an economics background, let me give you a couple of things that are going on here. First of all, there's great global demand for fuel. If you look at what's happened with the Chinese car market, back when I started covering the auto industry, if you look sometime in the 90s, there were probably 2 million cars a year sold in China. Now there are 14 million cars
a
year
sold
in China.
Really?
It's amazing. It's a bigger market than the United States.
So
first of all, that's 12 million more people that are using gasoline. If you look at India, the Indian car market is growing. If you look at Latin America, it's growing there too. You still obviously have demand in the United States. So you just have more people who want the use of gasoline or the use of oil-produced products. So that's just demand alone sends up the price. The second issue is obviously world instability. And it isn't that we have any problems with the supply, but there's always the threat because of the tension in the Middle East that we could see the supply interrupted. And then third, there's the issue of speculation. And this is something that drives the airline industry crazy because the price of jet fuel, jet fuel is kerosene, but it's derived from oil. And the price of jet fuel is now up again as well. And that's going to show up this summer when people try to travel for summer vacation. So everybody is feeling it and everybody is trying to pass along the increase to consumers. Consumers are in the worst situation to be able to handle that increase. You're talking about people making decisions between, you know, giving up a vacation to giving up on some groceries to giving up on going out on the weekends, that sort of thing. You have to find a way to pay for this extra gasoline or you have to change your driving habits. Now, in a place like Chicago, where I'm speaking to you from, you can take public transportation. I'm able to walk to work, and I even did so last winter when it was 7 degrees. I don't necessarily recommend it.
No.
But I can do it if I have to, if I decide that I can't spend $4.69 a gallon for gasoline. But if you live in Wisconsin up north, if you live in the west part of the state, if you don't have a bus system, you have to drive.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's forcing people to make budget decisions on top of the budget decisions that they've already made. And, you know, in the past, people could say, well, I'll sell my big house and move. Well, good luck with that.
Exactly.
So this is really more, I think this is a bigger economic threat than Washington realizes. I think there's a lag in understanding what this means to people out here in the country. And I'm hoping that some attention will be paid to it. But a lot of it is out of our control simply because of all those people in China who are buying all those cars.
Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Extremely interesting topic.
Thank you.
Need to have Ford 150. May I ask a question? Is there at the present time, as it looked as we moved into this century, that there was a global overcapacity in the automobile industry, that, you know, there was about one-third overcapacity, so some players could have been expected to disappear, is that the case now with the growth of demand in India and China? And then as a second and perhaps related point, the major automobile manufacturers all want to be global manufacturers. And Ford was best in North America at being a lean and mean company, which explains its solvency. But GM is a major player in China. So are the American players in the process of becoming global producers? Would, say, GM be more likely to be a remaining player as we go forward? And thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank, as always.
Those are great questions. Thanks, Frank. First, on the overcapacity issue, I would say there is still overcapacity in the auto industry, which means that the car makers are able to build more cars and trucks than people want to buy. Now, in the United States, the car makers have just dramatically cut their capacity. If you think about what happened to General Motors and Chrysler during the bankruptcies over the last couple of years. If you think about what Ford did itself, voluntarily, essentially, with its Way Forward program, I believe the auto industry in the United States is now about 30 to 40% smaller than it was at the middle of the last decade. So that took out some of the vacant plant capacity in the United States. There's a lot of talk. I was just reading some tweets over the last couple of days. I'm very active on Twitter, and I'm Mickey, M-I-C-K-I Maynard, if anyone wants to follow me, and they should definitely follow Kathleen as well. But I would say that we are seeing people questioning whether the smaller Japanese manufacturers might be in trouble, whether we'll see some of them disappear from the American car market or be taken over by bigger Japanese players. We haven't actually gotten any Chinese manufacturers in the American car market yet, and everybody thought that we would have them by now. I remember going to auto shows in Detroit over the last 10 years and always seeing the Chinese cars and always hearing that we plan to be selling cars in the United States by 2010, 2011, 2012, and so far they're not here. So I believe what this is doing is dampening the Chinese sort of export ability, that they would be here already if the market hadn't fallen apart. And then your second question about global manufacturing. Well, General Motors, Ford, and to some extent Chrysler through Fiat, through its overseer Fiat, are all global manufacturers. They all have operations in Canada and Mexico. They all have operations in China and Europe. I think had the recession not happened, that all three of them would be bigger overseas than they are. General Motors actually is quite huge in China, but none of these companies are by themselves in China. Every major world manufacturer is there. So it's sort of an open playing field for global competition. I think what the car makers realized was, and I had been saying this for years, and I said it in my book, The End of Detroit, that you have to be strong in your home market. You cannot be weak at home and strong overseas. It just doesn't work. And I think that the bankruptcies and the troubles in this industry have given them a new realization of the importance of taking care of the North American car market.
You'd, of course, have to do a different book now, and maybe you are, but you really couldn't call it The End of Detroit anymore, could you?
No, it's sort of a new beginning for the American car market. And I think other people are writing that book. Paul Ingracia, who's an old friend of mine and is actually now at Reuters, but was with the Wall Street Journal for a long time. He wrote a book about sort of the recreation of the American car market. I just think 5 years from now, we'll have a better picture of what this market is actually going to be, because I don't think the Japanese will be weak forever. And I don't know how long the sort of good feelings about the Detroit car companies will last. You know, competition is a great leveler. So I'll be watching very closely to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Frank, for the call. Jeff in Waukesha, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
You may be familiar, I'm sure you are, with the Tesla Motor Company out in Fremont, California, named after Nikola Tesla. He was actually the inventor of the hybrid and gave us the ultimate hybrid vehicle, which was proved by Volvo with their concept car in the 80s called the Environmental Concept Car. When the Tesla hybrid is built to its complete form, it will allow us to have a full-size car that exceeds 100 miles per gallon and can burn any fuel, including crude oil, completely cleanly. And most people are not familiar with his history, but Nikola Tesla gave us our complete power system, including the hybrid car concept. Unfortunately, we're not using the entire Tesla scheme. We're only using part of it, and many claim that the current system is no more fuel efficient than the Hummer when you consider complete energy consumption and life cycle, including battery replacement. You can go and learn about this at a Milwaukee-based nonprofit called the Tesla Engine Builders Association at TeslaEngine.org, and you can read all about it. And it's a beautiful potential future that we have, and it's just a matter of getting these manufacturers, and of course it's political, because if we get just 35 miles per gallon fleet average, we're off of foreign fuel. So the main problem is not technology, it's politics, I'm afraid.
Mickey.
Well, it's very interesting to hear you talk about Tesla. There's actually a Tesla dealer in Chicago that I pass all the time. And right now, the cars sold by Tesla are quite expensive. I think their top-end Roadster is about $100,000. So I don't think that they're in the grasp of most of your listeners. And I do think that we are on the cusp of great adventures in alternative fuel vehicles. The fact that Toyota's been able to sell a million Priuses around the world, that other car makers are exploring hybrids and plug-in hybrids like the Chevrolet Volt and electric cars like the Nissan Leaf. This is just the beginning, and I'm really excited to see it. And I have a nephew who is 19, almost 20. He's a pre-med student at the University of Michigan, and he's fascinated by my hybrid, and I can see a day when he doesn't drive a car that's powered by gasoline. So this is going to be a very exciting time for all of us.
You know, when you think about this, and I must say, I think about it at least once a week, it causes me to just pause. Isn't it incredible how so much of our society is built around cars. You know, that we drive our car to work, and then we park the car, and we pay for parking, and the whole city has got streets on it for cars, and we just didn't think about being able to walk to work as you do. It's just an amazing thing.
Well, it is the growth of the United States in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Essentially, it was the century of the car. But, you know, Kathleen, when I talk to younger colleagues here at WBEZ and friends of my nephew and others that I know who are in their teens and 20s, I think this generation doesn't automatically see a car as a symbol of success. I know kids that skateboard. I know kids that ride their bikes. I know a lot of people that take public transportation. I know people who walk. I know people who just don't. They look at you like when you say, what kind of car would you like? They're saying, I can't afford a car, and I don't think I can afford a car maybe till I'm 30. So we're going to the Detroit car makers, the Japanese car makers and others, they can't automatically count on their products being what this generation aspires to. And what that could mean is that the way we use our cities, the way we use our suburbs, the way we use our college towns could all change. And I think that's fascinating. I took a architecture class. I'll say this real quickly, but
sure.
When I was at Columbia University, I studied with Robert A.M. Stern, who's a very well-known architect, just a fabulous professor. And he showed us literally the evolution of the suburbs after World War I. Because planners, for the first time, were able to build communities 20 miles and more out of a major urban area. And from the 1920s and then on through the war and then on through the interstate highway system, that is how we got to what we have today. But it didn't happen quite overnight, but it did happen because the car allowed it to happen. So for us to reverse that also requires new thinking about our cities, our suburbs, and our outlying areas.
Right. So have you tried skateboarding to work? I can't imagine doing it.
I have not tried skateboarding to work. I think walking is plenty dangerous enough for me.
I can't imagine doing that either. Thanks, Jeff. Tom in Soldiers Grove. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Couple questions. Was the bailout proper that the government did with the car companies? Was the right thing to do? Did it save them? Another question is, when Wall Street fell, why did the car manufacturers follow? How was that tied in? Thank you.
Tom, those are both great questions. And I'm going to leave it to your listeners to decide whether the bailout was proper. I will make the sort of following points. I think the bailout was a political decision. I think President Obama, I think he wanted to do something for the union movement in the United States, and I think he felt a responsibility to this region of the country as someone who spent his adult life in Chicago. And the Democratic Party supported him. Unions generally support the Democratic Party. There you go. As far as it being proper, there is a court system in this country, and I've covered plenty of bankruptcy cases through the years, conventional bankruptcies that where the companies had to go and find a bank to push them through the bankruptcy process and had to make deep cuts and had to make all kinds of decisions so it could restructure and come out of bankruptcy. You know, I've always argued that the courts were there for the car makers to use, and they could have done this at any time. And the feeling was nobody will buy a car from a bankrupt car maker. Well, the government came in and it guaranteed those cars. I don't know if people remember that, but they said that they would guarantee the repairs for 60 days, I think it was, after something was purchased if the car company went out of business. I have to go back and look up the specific language, but they also offered the Cash for Clunkers program to make sure that car sales rebounded after the bankruptcy. So I guess I would say the courts were there, but the argument was that the typical court process, which takes years, wouldn't have been right for the car companies at the time because the economy was so bad. And then as far as the Wall Street collapse is only peripherally connected to the Detroit car makers because they were in trouble for years. I wrote The End of Detroit in 2003, and General Motors and Chrysler ended up in bankruptcy in 2009. So it took 6 years for that to happen. I think that with Wall Street, what had happened was the borrowing that the car companies could have done from the banks, they were not willing to lend money to the car makers, even though from the reporting that I did for the New York Times, the Treasury Department had put a lot of pressure on some major banks to lend to the car companies, and the banks just said, no, we won't do it. We don't think that it's a good bet. So that's how the government ended up bailing out the car companies. It was politics, and it was the economic crisis.
Mickey Menard is our guest this hour. Mickey is senior editor of Changing Gears and author of several books, including The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. You can find her on Twitter, Mickey Maynard, MickiMaynard. And this Changing Gears is a very, very interesting project that is involving radio stations, public radio, in the industrial Midwest, and looking at the news that is emanating from this part of the country. And we really are giving the country a whole lot of news these days. She has a special interest and expertise in the economy and in the auto industry. She was a New York Times reporter for some 10 years. But they're also asking questions like, who's the best in Midwest music? We want to get to that because you can send a message to her. They will be covering that in upcoming Changing Gears programs. So it's a very, very interesting journalism project. And we're welcoming phone calls. We started with the news because we've had her on before, and she really knows what's going on in Detroit. The profits changing picture at Ford Motor Company, and today the news that Chrysler is doing pretty well. Thank you as well. So, but all of that could be stymied by high fuel prices. More phone calls in a moment. We also have an email we'd like to read. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Andrew Ferguson, author of Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course in Getting His Kid into College. We have a couple emails. Let's get to at least one of them. Mickey, from Lynn, my beloved Brownie, a 91 Honda Civic wagon, is dying. Great interior space and flexibility. She must feel so attached. High miles per gallon, great visibility for backing up. I would consider a domestic car, but there's nothing comparable. Ford Focus doesn't have a wagon anymore. The Jetta clean diesel sounds good, but the price? And oil companies have truckers over a barrel, so charge more for diesel, which hurts that choice. What can replace Brownie for her, do you think? And what do you think about her comments?
You know, that's tough because the station wagon market has pretty much dried up.
Mm.
The one thing that she might look at is what they call a small crossover vehicle, which is like a small sport utility vehicle, but it's more fuel efficient. It isn't quite as it's not based on the truck platform. It's based on a car platform. And then she's got all kinds of choices. The Ford Escape, there's the Honda CR-V, the Toyota RAV4, General Motors has products, Ford has products, that, you know, there's small Chrysler Jeeps as well. I think what she'll have to do is see what she's comfortable in. I'm sorry that there aren't small wagons anymore, or not very many of them, because I just think that was such a nice utilitarian vehicle. Now, my hybrid, my Prius, has a hatchback. And, you know, hatchbacks were not that popular in the United States. They remained popular in Europe and elsewhere, but we don't have that many hatchbacks. And I think it's very, very useful when you're loading something into the car and you get that extra roof room. But she's got to make a decision based on what she can afford and what car company she wants to support.
20 years for a car. That's not bad.
That's fantastic. And, you know, when I worked at USA Today, we had people who would write to us and say, I have 100,000 miles on my Civic. And we had someone write in and had, I think, 899,000 miles on their car. And those little cars, you know, they're Hondas are basically engines with cars built around them, because Honda is a great engineering company and they really are built to last.
Bob in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
A couple of questions. One on the race to the bottom. I've got a degree in American industry, and I can see that a new Ford employee can't afford to buy a new Ford, where the old Ford employees could. And as we ratchet down the pay of the workers, they're going to be unable to afford the products that they're making, and so demand goes down. The other comment, or the other question, is what do you think of the idea of the government selling its shares in Ford and General, or excuse me, and Chrysler and General Motors to the employees to change the motivation of management from making a profit to perpetuating the company?
Well, first of all, as far as being able to afford a car, you can afford a car. You just have to make choices. People are in the two tiers are making $16, $17, $18 an hour. You know, that's still, what, double the minimum wage in this country. So if you budget, if you make choices, you can afford a car. I don't think that you can afford any car. You just have to make a, you know, make a rational choice for the amount of money you make. And a second, you know, these are supposedly profit-making enterprises. These are corporations. They're not nonprofits and they're not employee-owned companies. And I don't know if it's the government's place to jump in and tell a company to become employee-owned. I think it's a decision made by the corporation's management, its board of directors, and the employees themselves. So honestly, there's so much talk about government motors when it comes to General Motors and the whole government ownership of that. I think the government wants out, and I think the companies want the government out as well.
Thanks, Bob. We go to Phil in Hebron. Hi, Phil.
Morning, ladies. Mickey, I've read everything you've written, and I'm a better person for it.
Oh,
you're a very good writer.
Thank you.
What a nice
Phil.
Call.
I really appreciate that.
I'm dead serious. Those books you write are incredible. I've read them and recommend them to a lot of people. I have two quick ones for you. I follow the automotive trade quite a bit. I'm in the city quite a bit in Chicago. And has the Volt had the it was supposed to have? Because I haven't seen a Volt yet. I've read about it in the Motor Trend and seen pictures. I've never seen a car on the road. My other question is a follow-up to the fellow you just talked to. The Wall Street Journal last week floated an idea that Mr. Obama would like to sell our shares at GM for an $11 billion loss because GM doesn't like the government owning the company. What do we care what GM thinks? They owe us money. We don't owe them money.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for that compliment. I'm really happy to hear that. I haven't seen a Volt on the road either, although I've certainly seen them at automotive events. But I believe in the first year they were only planning to sell 10 to 12,000 Volts, which for the whole country, they'll probably be sold mostly in the Detroit area and maybe on the coasts at this point. So it could be a while before we see them in everyday traffic. And they only expect annual sales to hit about 60,000 anyway. So that's going to be a scarce one. We'll be tweeting our Volt sightings, I guess. And second, I don't think anybody ever expected the government to make money on its investments in either of the car companies. And, you know, this I've been talking for many, many years, and you would know that from reading my books about industrial policy. And we've never really had one in this country. We never favored industries over each other. And you could argue that the bailout was a form of industrial policy. But, you know, if you're going to have an industrial policy, have a consistent one. Don't have a little bit of an industrial policy. It's like being a little bit pregnant. You can't really have that. So I think in the case of the government, they're not going to make money on these investments. It was a political choice, and it was something that Mr. Obama felt was good for our region and good for the country. And that's probably, to him, worth $11 billion.
Switching completely from cars, and we hope to get to one more phone call, but I know you would like our listeners to answer the question, who's the best in Midwest music?
Right. Changing gears. This is just one of the fun things that we're able to do with this project, because I was just at an event yesterday with a mayor-elect Rahm Emanuel, where he talked about the Uptown Music District that he wants to create in Chicago compared with the theater district that Mayor Daley created in Chicago. And Cleveland is the home of rock and roll. Next week, Changing Gears will have an event with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, looking at how we can boost the Midwest music scene. And as part of that, we want to try to find the best band with Midwestern roots or the best performer with Midwest roots. So we're asking people to go on our website, which is changinggears.info, and post their nominations for the best band based in the Midwest. It could be Wilco. It could be the guy down the street playing in his garage. Give us their name. Give us their URLs. Give us their YouTube links, or you could tweet it to me or to @CHGears and put on the hashtag Midwest Music. We're adding up all those nominations. We're posting them on our website, and we would love to have people join in that sort of competition and also give those bands and those performers some visibility, because while you can put your stuff up on the internet, you still have to let people know about it. So we are looking for our best folks, our best music folks in the Midwest.
Great. Phil, thanks for the call. We have time for one more phone call. Doug in Dodgeville. Hi.
Good morning. Question. Traveled from here in Wisconsin to Arizona, saw lots of oil wells, pumps out there, non-functioning. And this is when the oil started popping up there. This was the 1st of March. My question is, any idea how much the oil people in the United States are getting paid for their barrel there? Because during the last crisis, the governor of Montana, right now I can't think of his last name, it's either Schickner or Schneider or something, anyway, on one of his programs, and he said those guys out there were getting $19 a barrel. And on the spot market, it was $79 a barrel. The other thing that's kind of a fact.
All right, I need to hold you on. We can't do the other thing because we'll never get to it. Mickey?
I actually don't know the answer to that question. I unfortunately haven't followed that piece of it, but I will say that in our region, I think most of our oil comes from Canada.
Well, that'll do it then. Thank you very much, Doug, for your call. Well, you're always a lot of fun. I really like talking to you, Mickey. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's always a pleasure. I love Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's always fun to be with you.
Yeah, thanks. Best of luck on everything. Our guest this hour of the program, Mickey Maynard, she is now the senior editor of Changing Gears. And I would recommend you go and see what they're doing because it's a really interesting project. It's changinggears.info. She's also the author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. And they're doing this regional. They got a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they're doing regional news and regional shows on all of the issues that are of special importance to those of us who live in the Midwest. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return.